Here it comes, the latest people, trends, and news on sustainable living in and around our corner of the country. Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are listening to Down to Earth with Mrs. Green, Spotlight on the Southwest, for our special Sustainable Community Series. This 10-part series is highlighting the very important role that nonprofits play in creating healthy, sustainable communities in Pima County and all throughout Tucson. The series is sponsored by Desert Diamond Casinos, and we thank them for that. And thank all of you so much for joining us. Get ready for another interesting show tonight about a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to creating cultural revitalization and sustainable community development on the Tohono O'odham Nation. The name of our show is Spokes on a Wheel, and our in-studio guest is Terrell Johnson. He is the CEO and co-founder of the Tohono O'odham Community Action. Welcome, and thanks so much for being here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And I want to do a little bit of, maybe it'll embarrass you, but it's really good to know because I did some digging, of course. But in 1996, Terrell co-founded Tohono O'odham Community Action, TOCA, a grassroots community organization that was dedicated to creating positive programs based in the Tohono, in the O'odham Himdog. Is that, did I say that right?
No, but that's okay.
You say it. Say it.
O'odham Himatok.
O'odham Himatok, so I'm not going to say that again. That you'll be in charge of that cultural perspective. The Desert People's Way. In 2002, Terrell and TOCA co-director Tristan Reeder were recognized as one of the nation's top leadership teams when they received the Ford Foundation's Leadership for a Changing World Award. And I find that to be quite impressive. Terrell's collaborations range from museum exhibitions to documentaries and book publications. In October 1999, Terrell was named one of America's top 10 young community leaders by the Do Something Foundation. So I thought that was a really great way to put the setting out there of just who we have as our guest today for this show. I'm very excited about it.
Me too.
Okay. So why don't we start? It's always good to start sharing what the vision and the mission is for TOCA. And I think it's easier if we call it TOCA. We're going to take a lot of time up saying the long word, but it's up to you.
No, TOCA's fine.
Okay. How long you've been in operation and what's the mission?
Wow. Well, we've been almost 20 years now. I think, you know, it's been...
1996. Yes.
Yeah, it's been... Officially, 96 is when we got our 501.
Okay.
But we've been... doing this for 2 years before that, unofficially. And it just started with me meeting Tristan, who was a non-native that was on our reservation. And, you know, I was teaching basket weaving classes out of my own home, and the kids that were taking my class would go to the garden where he and his wife had started, and they were growing traditional foods. And, you know, I just was really excited that they had excited the neighborhood kids
right.
about planting. And so the kids would talk about this guy, this white guy. And I'm like, well, who's this white guy? Let me meet this white guy. So I met him. And, you know, after that, almost 20 years, you know, we've been doing this kind of work. And the whole idea was basically really to just do something really positive for the kids for summertime. Out on the reservation, we're very limited and positive programs for kids on the reservation, especially during summertime when school's not going on. And, you know, myself, my mother would try to keep my family, my brothers, I have five brothers, and, you know, she tried to keep us busy during the summertime when school was out. She worked, my father worked, and so...
It's really tough.
It was really, really tough. You know, they provide it, but, you know, she wanted to know what she can do with her kids for the summer. And for five boys, you know, with no supervision for the summer, that can get very scary.
Yeah.
So she would pass us around, you know, relatives, and they got tired of us. And so programs would happen. But, you know, again, there were limited resources for programs. And so there always was a waiting list. And so for myself, growing up like that, it was fun when we were in the classes or were occupied with programs. And, you know, but for others, you know, they just really didn't have any place to go. And so I was thinking, you know, if I can just get a building and a group of artists to come and teach other kids in the community or community members, you know, arts or anything really to keep them occupied, I think that'd be a really good thing to do. So
kids get interested. I mean, they do. They like to have something to do that's new and exciting and engaging in all different areas.
Especially, yeah, every areas, especially when it comes to cultural, something cultural based.
Yes.
And so I come from a cultural based background, but also a culture. And so I learned from my grandparents, who were luckily still alive. And I grew up with my grandparents, and they taught me everything that I know now. And then just elders that I know of that have been graciously, you know, teaching and passing it on to myself, along with other people that I work with. And so just having that opportunity, giving that opportunity to young people to do an experience was what the whole idea of what TOCA was. And everything that we do now just sort of evolved from that one little idea. And that became the basis of what we do. And that's to culturally vitalize the culture, the arts, the food, and the language. And that has been our whole entire basis of making this organization work and be successful.
And, you know, one of the pages on your website that I think was really great, and if you could share some of it, I actually have it pulled up here. I don't think a lot of people know, you know, kind of a little bit more in-depth details of the community context.
Mm-hmm.
You used to be known, when I moved here, as the Papago tribe.
Mm-hmm.
That name changed. Where is it? It's in the heart of the Sonoran Desert. So can you give us all, our listeners, a little bit of a community context for the culture that you're talking about?
Mm. Gosh. All right. Well, you know, again, we're probably the second largest reservation in the country.
That's huge to tell people.
Yeah.
That. It's really a vast geographic spread.
Mm-hmm. And well, surprising, there's amazing facts about it that, you know, a lot of people don't really understand. We always compare the state of Connecticut to the size of our reservation.
Right.
And I actually lived in Connecticut for about a year, and I'm like, oh my God, you know, there's millions of people here. And when I go back to my reservation, you know, there's less than, I would say, at least 20,000.
Very different density. Not kidding.
You know,
really
and,
different.
And one of the things that we use as an organization and to let people know is that, you know, on my reservation, there's only one supermarket. Imagine one supermarket in Connecticut, you know.
No, and is it Abash's?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And, you know, and the thing is that when I was in Connecticut, every corner pretty much had like a grocery store or a little, you know, place where you can get, you know, food and stuff, milk and all that. And it's just amazing. But we're right in the heart of the Sonoran Desert and been there for thousands of years. And, you know, traditionally our tribal land covered, you know, the bottom of the United States along with the top of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But when the government came and, you know, decided, oh, the natives need to live in this spot here, they literally cut our tribal membership, but also our reservation in half. So half of that's also in Mexico, and half of our membership is in Mexico as well. So, and they are now considered Mexican citizens. So
there's a unique presentation also, and that's a fact that I think a lot of people don't know or maybe not remember.
Yeah.
When you talk about, there's been a lot of interest of late, you've been doing this for over 20 years, and one of the things you talk about in your, like in your presentation to me, the notes that you gave me, is the Native Foods Movement. And I've been going to the food series that the U of A has been putting on. Dr. Gary Nabhan was a presenter. Maribel Alvarez, who does Tucson Meet Yourself, was a presenter. And there's a lot of discussion about the Native Foods Movements, Native American Foods Movement, once again turning to traditional foods. One reason is because of health. Can you expand on that a little bit, and why is that so?
Well, for myself, again, a lot of these programs and a lot of how I run TOCA is based on myself and my family and my community. And for myself, I have family that have diabetes, have died from food-related health issues. I myself, you know, am a diabetic, and, you know, there's a whole strain of of health issues for myself, but you know, just growing up like that and understanding that, oh, it's because we aren't eating the right kinds of foods. We're not moving as much as we used to. My grandfather, my grandmother, and my mother grew up as farmers. We were farming people, and in the village that I was a farming village.
Right.
Up to, I think, when the World War started, my grandfather actually was recruited to go fight, I think, the Second World War. And so he had to leave his family and his village and his farm. So that left my grandmother and her kids tending the farm, but because it was a lot backbreaking labor work, you know, my grandmother couldn't do that. So, you know, and that's when I think that's when the decline of us veering away from our traditional foods and our traditional way of living had affected us. So sort of, and then, you know, boarding schools came in, they took the kids away. They were trying to assimilate them, you know, and so they were trained to eat non-traditional foods, more commodity foods, more non-native foods. So again, you know, we were taught to do these things and not necessarily go work out in the field, but sit behind a desk or be a maid or be a mechanic or something like that, coming back to the reservation and implementing those things that they learned. So a lot of people weren't interested in farming. They weren't interested in doing the ceremonies. They weren't interested in doing all those things. But also the language had a big part in it as well. So then several years later, when I was born, when my mother and father had kids, they purposely did not teach language because they didn't want us to be treated the way they were treated in boarding schools when they were speaking their language.
They taught you English.
They purposely taught us English. And purposely taught us not to speak our language because they didn't want us to be affected the way they were in boarding schools. And with that, they taught us that, you know, you go to the store and you buy a loaf of bread and you buy milk and you buy eggs and you buy all these things that, you know, they didn't grow up eating, you know. And so we learned to eat and appreciate, I guess, you know, white man's food. Along with that came commodities. You know, the standard sugar, milk, flour,
right,
cheese, all that.
Right.
And that's
right.
What we grew up on. But thank God, you know, my grandparents were still at that age where they weren't going to just let their traditional foods and their language go. So, you know, every time I would spend time with my grandparents, I knew we always ate something that was from the desert or that they grew and harvested and prepared. And so I was very lucky. And really what's interested in that.
Like literally they planted seeds in you, no pun intended. I mean, they really did plant seeds deeply in you. And you know, when I had in all these food presentations that I go to, because I'm very, very interested in it, I believe it was Gary Nabhan who pointed out, it's not just that it's like the bad food that you got to eat, which it is, a lot of it, the white bread and all that. We know it for any culture right now. We're learning that is really bad. But what he talked about in the food series a couple of weeks ago is eating food from the area from which you are born and raised, that food is there to feed your system. You know what I mean? He made sense of it, that this food from this earth where you live is supposed to feed what your body needs. So the introduction for all of us of these foreign substances that are modified and changed and really in many cases not even food, severely impact health.
Oh, yeah.
And really are getting, you know, finally, I think it's getting some attention. So when you talk about, there's another piece of this, there's the food, which is so significant and important. And what are you doing about that to get kids and families to eat more of the native foods? Like, are you doing seed saving? Are you planting more gardens? How are you being a solution to that to help with the focus on traditional foods?
Mm. We're doing all that. you know, we are basically, again, it's a simple really process of really having it available for people that want to do it.
Right.
You know, we can't make people do it.
Right.
But we tell them, hey, listen, we have seeds. We have the knowledge. We have the manpower. We can help you. We can help you learn how to.
Get you excited about
yeah.
it. It's exciting to hear you talk about it.
Exactly. I mean, and that's the thing. That's our job, you know. But I think because it was our culture, I think a lot of people are very interested in it, you know, because it's like, earlier when we started this, when we started working with community members, they would always say, oh, I remember we used to do that. I remember my grandma used to go out in the desert and pick choya buds and pick mesquite beans and all this stuff. Or we used to do that. And it was always, well, if you used to do it, you still can do it. Now it's
we
like...
We can do it again.
Yeah. And then with the younger kids, it's we do it now.
We do it.
You know, and I love hearing that. And it's amazing. It makes me feel so old because back then I can always say, oh, remember you used to say we used to, but now we say we do it.
That's really good.
You know, but
it's a good part of feeling older.
Oh, it actually is.
You're seeing the changes.
We've seen the changes, and it's 20 years of working and telling people that we are now seeing the results. And we are actually now working with schools. We do food tasting for kids. We go to as young as early childhood up to high school and college.
Right.
And right now we are in the process of actually starting a food service program business on the reservation where we're hoping to provide traditional foods for all the schools. That's government, private, and state schools.
That's very exciting.
That's very exciting. But that, you know, it was a long time coming, and it was about 8 years of trying to get our foot in the door to get people to understand that it starts with the kids. You know, and I always tell people, you know, back then, way back when cigarettes were, there was a campaign to stop smoking.
Right.
People were it started with the kids. And you know, if you saw your mom smoking, you tell, you know, she's killing herself. Tell her that. You know, do all this stuff to make them understand you gotta stop smoking. Same thing with the food. You know, you had to understand, mom, you know, the donuts will kill you. You know, the fried bread will kill you. You know, those bad foods will kill you and hurt you. So we're trying to set the idea with the kids is that, you know, good food will make you feel better, will keep you healthy. And along with that, the culture will be alive. Because when you're looking at a tepary bean, tepary bean is a Dona Autumn traditional food that grows in the desert.
Okay.
And it's the only bean that I know of that is tolerant to the environment in the Sonoran Desert.
So it's really drought resistant.
It's drought resistant.
Which
less
matters
water
more and more and more.
Exactly. The less water you give it, the more it will thrive. It's the only plant that I know that during the heat of the summer, which in the summer it gets up to 115, 120 degrees, it survives. You know, and it thrives actually.
And what does it taste like? What do you do with it? Do you cook it like a bowl of beans, or do you put it as... I have no idea what
so. I actually bought you some, so I'll give you some. But,
yay!
And you tell me, but it's really good. And there's two different types that we grow. We grow a white bean and a brown bean. I bought you some brown beans.
Okay.
And it's just like a bean. You can boil it, you know, and
kind of like
can,
a pinto bean.
Like a
type.
Pinto bean, but a lot more healthier.
Okay, good.
And you can, it's very diversifiable. We actually have a cafe, a restaurant where we serve traditional foods, and we have hummus that is made from these beans. I actually just like it plain. With the white beans, I actually like it with some beef in it. But it's very diverse. So with any kind of bean, you can make chili.
And it thrives in the desert heat.
It thrives in the desert. And, you know, we just have that available for the kids. And we tell the kids, you know, this is not only a bean. You're looking at entire culture of the Dona Autumn people. Because with that bean, there's legends about it. You know, in our creation stories, Coyote was stole a bag of white beans and he was running and he tripped and the bag of beans flew into the air and it tore open and it spread it around the sky and it created the Milky Way, you know. But with those beans,
story.
With those beans, you know, we have to do prayers. We bless the ground. We bless the beans before we even plant it. But during when it's growing, we sing to it. We tell it, we encourage it to grow and be healthy and thrive so that the people can eat him and be healthy and thrive. So along with all those, you know, what that comes with the beans, we teach that to the children. We teach that to the community, and they get it. And at this point in time on the reservation, a lot of people are not only hungry for healthy food, but hungry for culture.
And wanting to rebuild that and connect. And it just, I mean,
exactly.
I have had enough experience now with interviewing people on the shows and just being an aware kind of person that it's just, there's just a revitalization and a circling back that's great. And one thing that I want to point out, we interviewed two amazing people from the reservation, from the nation. I don't want to say the reservation, I'm sorry. The nation that are doing the glass recycling program.
Oh, I love that program.
And it was really, it was a great interview. And one of the things they talk about, which you have just touched upon, is the importance of economic development, because it's great to want a job. It's great to be out there looking. The challenge becomes, and the depression and a lot of other, you know, maladies related to it, is if there are no jobs. So you're creating economic development through the restaurant, through, if you're going to do this food service program, that's a, you'll be creating jobs. Right?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, definitely. And that's one of the key points that we are trying to do. And being a nonprofit and working with foundations and organizations that give us money through grants, you know, those are things that they're actually looking for, is to be more self-sufficient. And it's really hard because this new concept of farming and making a living off of it is really hard.
Really, really hard.
Realistically, it's going to take some time, because a lot of people don't understand that you can make a living off of these things you grow in the desert, you know? And so we're working at getting people to understand, yes, you can. It's going to take some time, take some training, and just really take some faith in it. And so economic development is one of the biggest things that we are really trying to do. We have a program now where we are actually working with young people, but also community members, on getting interested in actually becoming farmers. We have a farm. We have actually two farms. We have a 180-acre farm that we grow and mainly do a lot of our huge productions of beans and squash and melons. We have a smaller farm, which is about maybe 40 acres, where we use it as a classroom. And we have people come and we train them on the basics of just farming, but actually flood-based farming, which is a traditional Thanaatham way of working the land. And that's basically not relying on irrigated water, but relying on seasonal water.
Right.
Monsoon rains. And most of our plants, traditional plants, thrive during the monsoon and grow through the monsoon for the summer crops. And for the winter crops, again, you know, it thrives in the desert as well. But so we actually teach people how to recognize the weather, if it's going to rain, how to plant, how to space your seeds, how to divert water when the washes are running, things like that.
So but we really also, be in touch with the cycles of nature, which
exactly.
is what farming in its inherently is and of itself is. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's, but it's not, it doesn't come naturally. It certainly doesn't. It has to be taught, because it's been taught out of us.
Yeah. But not only that, but it's also the cultural side of it, which is the songs, which is the ceremonies.
So tell us about that.
Well, you know, there's not really much to tell as far as, you know, we really respect what we learn from our elders, and we really with it rather keep it within our traditional cultural realm. And again, you know, it's just respecting and really just honoring what is passed down from our ancestors.
And, you know, in the show that I referred to about the recycling art, recycling the glass project, that's what happened. And it was, again, it was, you know, they just flat out said it, a white man and a native. And Richard thought, well, we're just going to go. He was the native. He says, we're going to go pick up
Richard.
Glass. You know, Richard. So,
yeah.
And he said he started picking up the glass and started saying, what do you feel? And it became a whole cultural exchange between he and his partner about, this is sacred land. This is what our kids are seeing. And it's, you know, they called them the cues, the quart bottles of beer. And a whole different thing came out of that experience because of the sacredness of, it didn't become about just picking up glass anymore. It became about clearing the land, changing the energy. So it's just, there's all that inherent cultural blessing is what I would call it in what you're doing.
Oh yeah. And it's the same with my relationship with my associate, Tristan. You know, he's my bridge to his community, and I'm his bridge to my community. And for over 20 years, you know, we've helped each other grow and learn and teach each other about each other's community and how it works. And, you know, for myself, I'm very fortunate with this job that I have for over 20 years to travel the world and just see different communities and see how, you know, things are how different communities are, especially in the Native communities, but also how similar they are with that and with non-Natives.
So you saw that happen. That was really quirky. Hmm. The other thing, it was like, for everybody that knows, this is Mrs. Green's world. And all of a sudden, a voice said, Gina. And that was pretty darn weird. So anyway, it's the Mercury in retrograde. I apologize for that, but it was kind of funny because yesterday the phone rang. Nobody touched it. And somebody started talking on the phone. None of us. There's just two of us here. And somebody started talking on the phone. Yeah, they're getting smarter than I am. And I don't like that very much. What about the, like the you mentioned in your notes, like the revitalization. It's a geographically spread out community. There's, you know, different areas that you have to cover. How are you managing or leading like the revitalization to feel that it's exciting and contagious and that kind of thing? What's happening? Because it obviously is.
Yeah. Well, okay, revitalization is just a word that we use to get people's attention and to let people know that, okay, this is what we're doing now.
Right.
I personally don't like that word only because, again, this is how we live. Oh, this is how I grew up. And a lot of other Native communities are a little bit more further than others. But it's just a matter of reminding people of where they came from and what they do.
That's such a good point. It's not revitalization. It's more like remembering.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is. And it's a much better word, remembering.
Yeah. And, you know, for myself, we are just reminding people of where they come from and what they used to do, you know? And so for myself and my community, we're just reminding people that this is who we are and this is what we ate and this is what we do. And if we go back to that, you definitely see the changes again on how, you know, you carry yourself, how you walk around with a sense of pride, knowing that, okay, I come from a culturally heavily rich-based community and culture. And a lot of the younger kids especially are thriving to know where they come from and really want to start planting their roots and figure out, again, you know, what is my purpose? What am I supposed to do? You know, who am I?
It's really exciting for you to having done this over 20 years to see it coming back that way. And that it's like, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to make sure I think we have about 3 minutes left. Oh. In that 3 minutes, I know, like it's really
gone
hard
by so
to,
fast.
It's very hard to believe. I want to just cover, what is the biggest challenge you face as the CEO and co-founder? Is there one that you can say? Is it funding? Is it getting people interested? Is it growing the programs? What's your biggest challenge that you face every day?
Funding is the biggest thing ever. Because again, you know, we're a nonprofit and we go for these grants along with 100 other organizations that are fighting for the same grant, you know, and it's, you know, last week I had to lay off 3 other people just because we just could not keep those programs.
It is really a jungle out there. And if you do the economic development model, which is what you're moving towards, that becomes self-sustaining. If
exactly.
you feed the schools, if you can grow the crops, that will help a lot.
Yeah. So if people want to come and support us and in several different ways, they can go to our website. That is tokaonline.org, or they can actually come to the reservation and come to our cafe where we serve traditional foods and a modern cuisine. We have a gift shop. We have a shop online.
And where is it?
Our gift shop and our cafe is in Sales, which is 60 miles west of Tucson, 70 miles south of Phoenix. And again, if they visit our website, they can definitely get directions.
And it's a gateway to Mexico, so it's a great idea to put that out there to our listeners as a place to stop and plan on having lunch.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's really a good idea. Do a little shopping, have some lunch. And again, everybody, it's Toca, TOCAonline.org. And I just think, I mean, I just looked when I got the 2-minute warning. I'm like, okay, I have a page and a half of questions left. But you really did cover a lot in a very meaningful and important way. And I want to thank you for that and the work you're doing. And everybody, I want to forward promote. We have some great shows coming up this Saturday. Again, about food, November 8th, James Costa, Lunch Hour, What We're Feeding Our Kids in Schools, and it's pretty gross. That's changing too. And then on November 11th, another Down to Earth, Kimber Lanning, who is really the queen of buying, thinking, eating, drinking, everything local. She is the director of Local First. And thank you so much for what you're doing. And I hope that this results in some raised awareness by our listeners. And thanks for all you're doing to make the world a better place.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.